Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
He kōna i purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
She put the hands over Ruby's mouth and nose to stop her breathing, and that's what happened. She went to the Blenheim police station and said to the police, "I've just killed my daughter and I feel like a robot."
Hi, I'm Jesse Mulligan and this is Crimes NZ, a podcast where I talk with people connected in some way or another with New Zealand's most notorious crimes. In this episode, I'm talking to barrister Simon Shammy about the killing of Ruby Knox, a death that was tragic in more ways than one. Simon defended Ruby's mother, Danella, who admitted to the murder.
Ruby was severely disabled her whole life. She had a lifelong history of multiple complex medical and psychological problems. And despite a lot of investigation and assessment, a clear diagnosis for her was never established.
She had all sorts of things going on. Can you run through some of them?
So she had all sorts of mental health issues. She had severe autism disorder where she had no speech. She couldn't communicate in any way. She had chronic behaviour difficulties, including aggression and self-harm. She'd bang her head against windows and doors and smash them and injure herself. She had huge amounts of physical problems. She had spina bifida and chronic bowel problems. So the list just really went on.
Yes, here is Justice Joe Williams, who presided over the case, describing Ruby's behaviour.
From two, Ruby exhibited what was called complex behaviour disturbance, characterised by increased physical activity. She would pull hair, headbutt and scratch other children. She would attack animals.
And here on her health conditions.
Spina bifida, complications relating to spinal rod surgery undertaken when she was 13, gastroesophageal reflux, seasonal asthma and rhinitis, a history of anal fissures related to her chronic constipation.
Yes, so very, very tough for this young woman. And did she have, Simon, any way of communicating that she was in pain or what was going on in her body?
Well, I think because she didn't have speech, it made it very difficult. But obviously her mother, Danella, knew her very, very well. Cared for her 24/7, basically, for 20 years. In fact, they shared a room for most of that time. So Danella had a pretty good idea as to when Ruby was in pain.
That audio we just heard, by the way, was courtesy of the New Zealand Herald. Now, you heard from Ruby and Danella's doctor in court, and what did he say about her condition?
Well, it was quite interesting because the doctor who we heard from had seen Ruby and Danella on about 150 occasions. Boy. And to use his words, he got to know the chronic and exhausting issues that Danella faced. Ruby was always large and strong. She'd attack her mother, biting and pulling hair. But Danella just put up with it. It had a huge effect, obviously, on the doctor. He was very upset and when he saw what had happened.
Ruby didn't go to school because she couldn't communicate. She didn't have any friends because she didn't have an ability to empathise. Presumably she couldn't have pets either, Simon.
No, I mean, she was entirely innocent, obviously, but she would kill pets, literally. So, you know, it was a very unusual and very difficult situation for her mother. I mean, her mother couldn't have a partner because Ruby were just required such a high level of intense supervision.
How did Daniela manage those sort of physical aspects of looking after what was a pretty big and strong young woman?
Yeah, and I think it was something, I know that Daniela had to get, say, safety glass put in the windows because Ruby could break them and hurt herself. I remember Daniela telling me that, you know, if she was in the shower, Ruby would go and get a knife out of the drawer and start cutting herself.
Man, oh man.
So it was very, very difficult because I remember quite clearly reading the assessments that Daniela was having panic attacks and anxiety because, you know, Ruby would wake up and what was going to happen today.
Did she have any help looking after Ruby?
Yeah, she did. She had carers through, I think, the health board. But the difficulty was that carers found it extremely difficult to care for or supervise Ruby for any length of time. And, of course, the money that carers are paid doesn't work out at a great deal per hour. So it was very hard to have steady carers. They kept coming and going.
And she looked after this girl for 21 years. What was going on in the weeks leading up to Ruby's death?
Well, there were a number of things. Primarily, what I recall is that the rod that was in Ruby's back had apparently shifted slightly, and Daniela was very concerned that this was causing Ruby a lot of pain, and she took her to the doctor a few times or to the hospital. But they didn't really think that was what was happening. And really, it got to the stage, I think, for Daniela that this girl was in chronic pain, really bad pain, that her mother could understand but couldn't be communicated to clinicians. And I think that's probably the straw that broke the camel's back.
Right. The doctors told her there wasn't much more they could do for Ruby despite her being in an extremely desperate state.
Yeah, I think she got a letter from the health board on the day that Ruby died, just saying basically that they didn't think they could do anything about it. And she effectively felt like she'd hit a brick wall. And I think that's what happened.
So what happened on the day of Ruby's death?
So on Ruby's death, what happened is that Daniela gave her some sleeping tablets more than normal because, of course, you know, the treatment was always to try and sedate Ruby a bit, which Daniela didn't like. That's one of the reasons she didn't want to put her in an institution. And so anyway, on the day in question, Daniela gave Ruby some sedatives. And then when she was sedated, she put the hands over Ruby's mouth and nose to stop her breathing, and that's what happened. And then within an hour, she went to the Blenheim police station and said to the police, "I've just killed my daughter and I feel like a robot." And that was what her first words were.
Boy, oh boy. Okay, and it's hard. It's hard not to have some sympathy with her. I think is that fair to say? Not with the action she took, but
the more places the highest value on a human life, and that's why 99% of sentences for murder are life imprisonment with at least 10 years non-parole. And it's only when a very high test is met that someone gets other than life imprisonment. And it has to be truly exceptional, both in terms of the offence and the offender. And one of the very few cases in this country was Daniela Knox.
So what happened legally at that point?
So what happened was that we had what was called a sentence indication hearing in front of Justice Williams. And we provided an awful lot of evidence to His Honour in terms of psychiatric assessments of Daniela, as well as a lot of information about how things had been with Ruby. And His Honour reached the view that a sentence of 4 years imprisonment would be an appropriate sentence, that it would be manifestly unjust and unfair in the circumstances of this case to impose life imprisonment on Daniela.
As her lawyer, were you satisfied with that?
Yes,
what were you arguing for?
Well, I think I always argue a little bit lower, Jesse. At the end of the day, this woman had had a 20-year sentence, and that she was undergoing such problems mentally at the time that, you know, she took her own daughter's life, that the punishment was more than anything a court was going to impose.
So what year was that?
2016.
Okay. Is she out now?
Yes. So when you are sentenced to a finite sentence of imprisonment, and it's over 12 months, you can apply for parole after a third. And I think she did about coming up for two-thirds of her sentence, and the parole board released her on the basis that she was no danger to the public. She had done a lot of rehabilitation in prison in terms of after having 20 years of the sort of chronic stress and responsibility that the board thought it was okay to let her out on parole.
Have you stayed in touch with her?
Not really. Sometimes she'll contact me with questions about things, but by and large, I think Danella just wants to move on with her life. She's incredibly traumatised by everything, by both Ruby's life and her death, and I think she just wants to quietly go away and have a quiet life and forget about it as much as possible.
Yeah. What was the public reaction, by the way, when she was sentenced to just 4 years?
Well, it was interesting because it was anticipated by everybody involved that there would be quite a public reaction because, of course, one of the major problems, or not problems, but issues with giving someone a four-year sentence for murder is that it implicitly says that someone's life was only worth 4 years. And there were protests, and it was interesting because one of the points that the Crown Prosecutor made to the judge at the time was, look, there'll be a lot of criticism if Your Honour doesn't, gives her a four-year sentence. And the judge said, well, you know, he was just going to have to do the right thing, and he wasn't scared of criticism. But it isn't about the value of a life. It's about trying to assess the blameworthiness or culpability of Danella, and that was what His Honour thought was the correct sentence in view of her blameworthiness.
And so I suppose useful to look at what we might learn or change from this case. The case led to a call for sweeping changes.
Yes, and I think there was a review, which I don't know a great deal about, but from what I understand, none of the individual clinicians or health workers were blamed, which is only fair. I think there were recommendations for a review of the systems in place, and I think it was a little bit of a perfect storm because, of course, this occurred in a small provincial town. There's a high turnover of clinicians. It's very hard to get specialists. And I know that Danella travelled the country trying to get someone to try and diagnose some of the very complex issues that Ruby faced.
Here's the Auckland paediatrician, Dr. Rosemary Marks.
I think everything was done that could be done in the context of the current situation in New Zealand. So the nursing staff to whom the first call was made called Donella, and she indicated that she'd been feeling really stressed at the time and she'd had a bit of a blow-up, and reassured them that she had no intention of harming Ruby. At the second time, Ruby was actually admitted to Wairau Hospital, and she was in for a few days, and there was a number of discussions, and the staff asked Donella to stay with Ruby in hospital, and Donella decided to take her home, and it was fairly shortly after that that the event happened.
That's Dr. Rosemary Marks, and here she is again talking to then host of Morning Report, Guy Espiner.
I think it's really important that there is a a balanced investigation. The police could have been called and weren't, and I know that there have been discussions locally about when staff should call the police.
Well, that's really important, and sorry to stop you there, but who could have and when, at what point, who should have possibly called the police?
I think the Section 195A, I think it is, of the Crimes Act, says that if you are concerned about a person, then you should take reasonable steps. Mm. Now, I think they did took reasonable steps, and I think health professionals throughout the country would agree.
But the police weren't called.
But the police were not called.
Even after the 15th of March 2016 threat to drive off a cliff.
Well, that was the occasion when staff were basically reassured, and there were people in contact with the family. One of the other things I highlighted was the fact that the health system was not aware that she was not attending school, and the hospital system was not informed of the number of, was not aware of the number of GP visits, and the disability support system, you have to ask it the question of whether people are actually claiming the disability support. So although there was a big package in place, it wasn't being used.
That section of the Crimes Act that she mentioned, Simon, section 195, does that very often come up in New Zealand? Is it often used?
I don't think it is, really. And I think that on previous occasions, it was probably more likely Danella venting. I think that it just happened to be that things got worse and worse for her, and on the day she got this letter. And probably the I'd like to drive off a cliff kind of remark was just a cry for help. And, you know, she kept making efforts to get things better for Ruby.
We're talking about the death of Ruby Knox, the murder of Ruby Knox by her mother and caregiver Danella Knox. It was murder, wasn't it, in the end, Simon?
Yes, it was. She pled guilty to murder.
And was sentenced to 4 years in prison. Here's Justice Joe Williams again, courtesy of the Herald.
In going through this exercise, I have become very sure of one thing. To sentence you to life imprisonment for Ruby's murder would clearly be inappropriate, or, in the words of the law, manifestly unjust.
Was there any concern that by giving her a comparatively light sentence, it might be sending a message to other people in similarly desperate situations, other caregivers, that it might be a price worth paying?
No, I don't think so. I think there was so much material before the court about how much Danella loved Ruby, but also the huge difficulties that she faced and the effects on Danella of those difficulties, that it really was a perfect storm of so many factors that really made it inappropriate to sentence her to life imprisonment.
I don't know if this is a tongue-in-cheek comment or not, but I have a note here that one of her friends said that 2.5 years in prison probably seemed like a rest after being carer for 24/7 for over 20 years.
Yes, and a number of her friends and relations said that to me, because this woman would work and care for Ruby on all sorts of levels, flushing her bowel, cleaning her up, doing all sorts of things that I don't need to tell you, but every waking moment of her day, she was caring for this very large, very high need, very aggressive child. And yeah, I remember very clearly that Danella would tell me they'd watch TV together, and Ruby would lean over towards her, and Danella sometimes would get a lovely little kiss on the cheek, and sometimes she'd get a big bite. So it's impossible for those who haven't gone through that for 20 years to have any idea of how stressful that would be. And so to answer your question, a bit of time to yourself where you're not running around looking after someone else would probably have been very good for her.
Yeah. And we probably haven't talked enough about that there was a lot of love between Danella and Ruby.
Oh, look, you know, Danella's phrase was she thought they were going to make old bones together. All they had was each other. There was no partner, no husband. And literally, Danella travelled the world trying to find things that would make Ruby better, that would make her life happier. And she, you know, would pester doctors on numerous occasions to try and get some kind of help to ease the pain that her daughter was in. And her daughter was in chronic pain. And her mother, as her mother, Donella knew.
Interesting. Well, one of the conditions of Donella's early release that was that she wasn't to talk to any media. So no chance of a tell-all magazine or TV deal or book where we get things from her perspective.
Yes, and I think the parole board did that simply to facilitate Donella's rehabilitation and reintegration back into the community without, you know, a whole lot of media camped outside her front door so that she could stabilise and just walk away from the whole thing.
Can you tell us a bit about what she did while she was in prison?
Yes, she had one-on-one psychological treatment in prison because, of course, she had this very tough view where she felt like she was the only one who could help Ruby, and she kind of had counselling about that and to try and help her understand her views of things and how she could move on with her life. And so she did a lot of that when she was in prison.
How does it rank among the other cases that you have represented in your life, Simon? Certainly one of the more memorable ones?
Certainly one of the more memorable ones, and one where I can look back and say I think justice was done in a very difficult case with a lot of competing considerations. It took a large amount of work from a lot of professionals, like a team of people looking after Donella, to get the appropriate information before the sentencing judge so he could have a clear view of both Donella and Ruby's life.
Is this just a horrible situation that might not be avoidable?
Well, I think it comes back to the large raft of issues that Ruby faced. There weren't just one or two issues. There were dozens. And they all combined that we had this person, not only with an intellectual disability, but no speech and chronic pain. You know, it really was a perfect storm. And it occurred in a small provincial town, with a solo parent with very limited financial means and limited sort of social support. So on every level, it was a perfect storm that hopefully won't be repeated.
You've been listening to Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. You can catch more of me Monday to Friday hosting RNZ's afternoon show, and you can find more episodes of Crimes NZ on the RNZ podcasts page. It's also on Apple, Spotify, iHeart, or wherever you catch your favourite podcasts. Don't forget to follow the series, and if you enjoyed it, give it a rating so others can find it too. And if you like this one, you might also enjoy Black Sheep. It's a look at some of New Zealand's shady historical characters.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.